Vision of the Finance Committee into order, and they'll take some overviews this afternoon. For those of you who are watching, we're in the audience, after the budget overviews, we will gavel out of the Finance Division and into the Policy Division to hear two policy bills. And just as a reminder, you need to be here when we gavel back into the Policy Division, or you will not be considered to have been present for that. So we will start now. I have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have with us Jeff Edblad and Kelly Mitchell. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead and make your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Edblad. I am the Isanti County Attorney. I'm also the chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. With me is our Executive Director, Kelly Mitchell, and we appreciate the time that you have for us this afternoon. In 1978, Minnesota created the nation's first Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It was an act by the Minnesota Legislature in 1978 that set up a sentencing guidelines system that provides the legislature with structure for determining and maintaining rational sentencing policy. Through the development of our sentencing guidelines, the legislature determines what will be the goals and purposes of our state's sentencing system. Minnesota sentencing guidelines generally represent the goals of the criminal justice system, and they specifically recommend the appropriate sentence for an individual based upon offense severity and the offender's criminal history. And it's important for the committee to keep in mind that the majority of felony offenders in the state of Minnesota, approximately 74.9%, receive the recommended guideline sentence. Also, it's important to keep in mind that the Minnesota sentencing guidelines do not apply to first-degree murder cases and certain sex offenders which carry mandatory life sentences pursuant to the legislature. With regard to the sentencing guidelines grid structure, the vertical axis represents the severity level of the offense from the low end of a severity level 1 to a high end of a severity level 11. And the horizontal axis shows an offender's criminal history. Criminal history includes their prior record of felony offenses. It includes the prior record of potential targeted misdemeanor offenses. It includes the possibility of a point from juvenile convictions up to a certain age, and also custody status as to whether or not they are on supervised release at the time of the offense. Each of the cells in the grid has a recommended duration or a recommended time for a proposed sentence. And the big black line that runs through the guidelines is a dispositional line. And the big black line running through the guidelines is a dispositional line that distinguishes whether an individual under the sentencing guidelines would be going to prison or whether they would be receiving a probationary sentence. Anything below the dispositional line, anything in the gray boxes, are presumed to be probationary offenses. Anything above the dispositional line under the guidelines are presumed to be executed prison sentences, with the duration of that prison sentence articulated in the specific grid, or specific box cell of that grid. In 2006, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission created a second grid. We created a separate second grid dealing with sex offenders, and we did this in recognition of the unique nature and dynamic of sexual offenses. An attempted first-degree murder has its own grid under the guidelines as well, separate from our original grid and separate from the sex offender sentencing grid.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Senator Dzik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back to the horizontal axis with the criminal history score, do you include juvenile sentence if they've had a juvenile record, or is that not included, or does it kind of vary?
Mr. Chair, Senator, formula varies. It depends upon the age of the juvenile, the juvenile conviction. You can only have one criminal history point as it relates to prior juvenile convictions. And it's not a one-for-one. One conviction would equal 1 point for sentencing purposes. And there's a decay factor that you can only consider the prior criminal history as it relates to a juvenile point up until that believe that the offender is 24 years old, and at that point you can no longer consider a juvenile criminal history point for sentencing purposes.
Okay, thank you.
The goals of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission are as follows. The Commission maintains and modifies the sentencing guidelines that govern felony sentences in the state in order to support the articulated sentencing goals of the Commission. We do this to better assure public safety. We do this to promote uniformity in sentencing so that offenders who are convicted of similar crimes with similar criminal records and similar criminal histories receive similar sentences. We do this to provide truth and certainty in sentencing. We do this to establish proportionality in sentencing by emphasizing a just deserts concept and philosophy where the punishment fits the crime. First-time offenders being convicted of violent offenses and those with extensive nonviolent records are the individuals who are recommended for prison commits. When we're talking about truth and certainty, we're talking about a determinate sentencing structure. A determinate structure meaning that offenders actually receive the amount of time pronounced for their sentencing. There is no parole board in Minnesota that makes early release decisions under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. And pursuant to Minnesota Statute 244.101, offenders sentenced to prison must serve at least two-thirds of the pronounced sentence time in prison, and the remainder would be spent on supervised release. From the standpoint of just deserts, we're talking about a concept where similarly situated individuals are punished fairly and not necessarily a soft-on-crime or thug type of approach of sentencing. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is made up of representatives from each of the major stakeholders in the criminal justice community. Eight members of the commission are appointed by the governor, including a standing seat for the Commissioner of Corrections, currently Commissioner Tom Roy, a peace officer, currently Sergeant Paul Ford of the St. Paul Police Department, elected county attorney, currently myself in my capacity as the Isanti County Attorney, a public defender, currently State Public Defender John Stewart, a probation officer, current member being Jason Anderson from the Minnesota Department of Corrections, officed out of Grand Rapids, as well as three citizens. One of those three must be the victim of a violent crime. Our citizen members are Connie Larson, Sarah Walker, and Yami Vang. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court also has three appointments to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, one representing each branch of the court. And the Chief Justice's current appointments are Justice Christopher Dietzen, Judge Heidi Shellhaus from the Court of Appeals, and Judge Caroline Lennon from the district court level. With regard to commission responsibilities, a major responsibility of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is to maintain the guideline structure through an annual modification process of the sentencing guidelines. And we make modifications to the guidelines based upon a number of different areas. The first being legislative changes. We look every year as to what the Minnesota legislature does with regard to the passing of laws or passing of bills that are signed into laws regarding new crimes, or if there have been any changes to existing laws or the penalty structure for any existing laws, and we act accordingly. If there are crimes amended in any fashion by the legislature, we will act accordingly. We also make changes based upon case law. Looking at and reviewing appellate level case law from the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court, there will often be issues identified that affect the sentencing structure in the state of Minnesota. We will make modifications accordingly. We will also make modifications based upon federal law. And I think back to 2004 when the United States Supreme Court issued the Blakely versus Washington decision as it related to impacting sentencing guideline structures, that Minnesota was the first of the sentencing guideline states in 2004 to have in place a short-term recommendation as well as a long-term recommendation as to how the Supreme Court's decision in Blakely would impact the rules of procedure and the statutes in Minnesota with regard to sentencing. So we do respond to legislative changes and issues that are brought by the courts and decisions, and we also respond by issues that are brought to us by stakeholders and concerns citizens and constituents. We've addressed issues that have been brought to us by citizens. We've addressed issues that have been brought to us by victim groups. And we frequently address issues that are brought to us by practitioners who are litigating criminal cases in the trenches and have some type of an issue that comes up with regard to the case, and they bring it to us for clarification. We do this on an annual basis. Other responsibilities of the commission include evaluating outcomes of changes in sentencing policy. We address fiscal notes provided to the legislature with detailed analysis of the impact on adult offenders from bills that are introduced. So anytime there's a bill introduced, we will work to put together a fiscal impact as to that bill regarding sentencing issues and look at what the financial impact is going to be with regard to prison bed space coming down as a result of this proposed law. We also provide reports as requested by the legislature and other policymakers. As you're aware, we have an annual report to the legislature that's presented and due by January 15th of every year. We also analyze trends and make appropriate recommendations. We have data we monitor on all offenders convicted of a felony and sentenced under the guidelines, and we have this data going back to 1980. And we look at the data, we look at trends as it relates to the past 32 years of felony sentences in the state of Minnesota. We also publish reports on annual statistics and summaries regarding crimes of interest to the legislature, as well as crimes of interest to general stakeholders in the form of assault statistics, criminal sexual conduct statistics, and statistics involving dangerous weapons. We're also very active in providing education on sentencing law and policy to stakeholders. We do annual presentations to probation officers, judges, practitioners, college groups, law students, and try to get out and provide education as to what we're doing and how sentencing felonies work in the state of Minnesota. All of our work is guided by data we've been collecting, as I'd mentioned, since the guidelines went into effect in 1980. In 1981, we had 5,500 felons sentenced in the state of Minnesota versus our most recent year of full statistics of 2011, where we saw 14,571 felons sentenced. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission monitoring data are offender-based. The cases are collapsed into one case for offenders sentenced in the same county within a month. We saw a 1.8% increase in case volume from 2010 to 2011. We saw a large growth in the number of offenders sentenced for felony convictions beginning in 2002 to 2006. And if you think back to the offenses that were driving the train as it relates to felony offenses in the years from 2002 to 2006, these were the years that we saw the boom with regard to methamphetamine manufacturing and the methamphetamine labs. And this was also the time period that we also saw the implementation of the felony driving law. It also appears, though, in looking at the statistics, that both of the trends have appeared to have leveled off as it relates to felony DWI sentencing and the sentencing on the controlled substance cases as it relates to the methamphetamine manufacturing. As it relates to the volume of offenders sentenced by offense type from 1981 to 2011, you can see from the slide and from the graphic that the growth and the increase that we're seeing right now are in regard to person crimes. Person offenses made up 32% of the overall volume of offenders sentenced in 2011. Person crimes in 2011 was an increase of nearly 2% from 2010. And this represents the highest percentage of an increase in volume since the guidelines went into effect in 1980. We can attribute a significant amount of this growth to domestic-related areas, an increase in domestic assault-related offenses, felony domestic assaults by strangulation, and felony violations of restraining orders. These all would have been sentenced as gross misdemeanors prior to the felony version of these offenses being put into effect. So it's the increase in the domestic assault-related felonies that are driving the increase in the person offenses in 2011. You can also see that property offenses were down, and drug offenses overall make up 23% of our volume, which is the lowest percentage since 1999. The other category, the catch-all, it's 22.2% of the volume, up from 17.1%. This is an increase as it relates to pornography cases as well as the voting fraud cases. We've seen an increase in this category up from 2010. We do, though, believe that these voting cases were an anomaly resulting from media attention that was cast upon felons voting and that issue. Felony DWIs, again, important to remember that these are down 1% overall.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick. Actually, before you go on, I'm going to note we do have a quorum now.
Senator. Thank you. Can you go back to discussing the increase in person, the level of person crimes? So was it just generally we're seeing an increase in domestic assaults, or is part of that because some of the domestic assaults were changed from a misdemeanor level to a felony level, or is it a combo? I wasn't quite clear.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is that we're seeing a little bit of the combo platter, but the larger portion of it deals with offenses that would have been charged and sentenced as gross misdemeanor offenses prior to the enactment. Felony penalties on these laws.
Senator Sharon.
I'm new to learning these things, so that change created what outcome in terms of how the person's penalty would be?
Mr. Adblad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, certainly. Under Minnesota law, we've got certain statutory definitions of criminal offenses. We have got petty misdemeanor offenses, which technically are not crimes by nature. The common petty misdemeanor offenses we would see would be your speeding violations, not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign, penalties that have a maximum, or offenses that have a maximum penalty of a $300 fine and no incarceration obligation. Next up, we have our misdemeanor level offenses. A misdemeanor level offense carries a maximum penalty of 90 days imprisonment and a $1,000 fine. Our common misdemeanors that we deal with in the criminal justice system are the first-time driving while impaired, first-time assaults, the disorderly conducts, no insurances, certain driving offenses. Next up, we have our gross misdemeanor offenses. Gross misdemeanor offenses carry a maximum penalty of a $3,000 fine and 1 year incarceration. And once you get to the felony level offenses, the felony levels are a minimum of a year and a day in prison. So a number of these domestic-related felonies now that we're seeing at this point would have been charged out as gross misdemeanor offenses prior to the enactment of the felony sentencing provision of those statutes. And a gross misdemeanor is not eligible for a prison sentence. Those would be sentenced to a local jail in terms of probation. So the increase that we're seeing from a sentencing standpoint deals with the fact that offenses that under the old statutory scheme would not have been eligible for a potential prison sentence because they were gross misdemeanors are now eligible for potential prison sentences because they've been eligible for felonies.
Senator Schumer.
Yeah, thank you. And has that been in place long enough to determine the impact of that shift on the behavior, on the assaults, domestic assaults, for example? Are you seeing a correlation between making the penalty more severe from gross misdemeanor to felony and a reduction in recidivism or in threats to whomever that is that they're endangering?
Mr. Adblad?
Mr. Chair, Senator, off the top of my head, I don't know, and I don't know if Ms. Mitchell has that information, but if she doesn't, be happy to relay your question to John King, the Executive Director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and perhaps some follow-up with Mr. Kingery would be able to give you some information. I can't speak on what's going on among the 87 counties and the different dynamics as to how these cases are being handled.
Ms. Mitchell, do you have any information on that?
No, I do not. We only track the felonies, so I think that would take a combination of looking at the filings at all levels, which is beyond the information that we have at the guideline system.
Senator Shanks. Just one follow-up, and then you can tell me to be quiet, but I'm curious. Was that the motivation for the change? Was the motivation of moving from gross misdemeanor to felony to increase the seriousness of the message of the seriousness in crime and to defer, thinking that it might defer activity?
Mr. Eblad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as a member or a longtime member of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Board of Directors, this is something that we discussed significantly, and the felony strangulation was promoted very heavily by former. The felony level offense of that was promoted heavily by former Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner. We discussed it quite a bit at our board meetings, and the desire was to take some of these domestics, and all domestics are personal. Don't get me wrong, with something being personal, but when you are standing close enough to another human being who you're involved in a domestic relationship with, applying the force and pressure to that person's windpipe to affect that person's breathing, we're dealing with a very, very personal offense. And the seriousness of that is one of the reasons that we as an association are making that a felony offense. And from the standpoint of dealing with some of the order for protection violation cases and those issues, there were a number of people that we see cycling through on these violations. We'll often see some of the same people who are the subject of restraining orders coming back into court repeatedly, time and time and time again, knowing that there's only up to a certain level of penalty that they face on this. And we felt it was very important to have that felony option to address those individuals who were the worst of the worst as it relates to these repeat violations of orders for protection, as well as from that very personal nature of how close you have to be and the amount of force and pressure that you have to put while strangling someone. The fact that you're looking into that person's eyes and smelling their sweat and are close and personal, it's a horrific situation when you're talking to victims who have experienced this type of offense, Senator, and I really appreciate the question, though. Thank you.
Maybe I could add one note. If you get into the felony, either the strangulation or the felony domestic assault, because you've got priors, has your experience been that most of those cases end up falling below the line into the presumptive stay categories when you look at the sentencing guidelines grid, or are they presumptive commits?
Mr. Chair, from the standpoint of my own jurisdiction or from the standpoint of statewide?
Well, whatever information you have.
Certainly. And from the standpoint of statewide, I guess I can't presume, Mr. Chair, to speak about that, but I'd certainly be happy to pass, again, the question on to John Kingery, so Mr. Kingery can provide that type of information.
Mr. Kingery's taking diligent notes back there, I can see.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Did you have something from your own jurisdiction or Ms. Mitchell?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to let you know that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does produce a report on assaults annually, so we can tell you what the sentencing practices are. I don't have them off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to send that over so that you have a clear picture of where these offenders are falling each year.
Okay. I mean, I would guess when you get to the point for felony domestic assaults, by their nature, even if it's a fifth-degree level assault, they're felonies because there are priors, and you would have some criminal history score that would get calculated into where they fall on the grid. But not every felony is based on a predicate like that. It might just be that felony strangulation could stand alone as a first-time offense, as I understand it, correct? So,
Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes.
And I would assume that is a presumptive stay. As a first-time offense, is that right?
Mr. Chair, with a criminal history score of zero, a felony strangulation would be a presumptive stay. I believe you need to have a criminal history score of approximately either three or four for a felony strangulation to result in a presumptive prison commitment.
That doesn't mean they're not going to incarceration. It just means they'd be incarcerated for some period of time, less than a year and a day, in a workhouse, in a
Mr.
local
Chair,
in a local jail. Basically.
That is correct. There would be terms and conditions of felony probation, including jail time, any type of restitution, any type of chemical dependency evaluation, domestic abuse assessments, anger assessments, potentially no contact orders. Are there restitution issues? Often when we're dealing with felony domestics, we also see that the course of conduct in felony domestics, especially the strangulation area, also could be charged as other levels of felony assault, depending on the level of bodily injuries. But it's not uncommon to see a felony domestic as an alternate count of a felony assault in the third degree because of substantial bodily harm that's been inflicted during the course of the transaction.
And if they fail to abide by the terms and conditions of probation, they still face the possibility of executing a felony sentence if they come back to the court. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, that if someone who is on a stayed prison sentence with probationary terms, if they do violate any terms and conditions of the of that probationary sentence, the Department of Corrections has the full authority under the law to file a violation report and bring that offender back for the court. The court does have the option upon making a finding of violation of either reinstating that person on probation with additional sanctions and terms and conditions, or has the option of revoking the stay and committing the person to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections for placement in the state prison.
Thank you. Does that raise any questions, Senator Sheeran?
Well, I was thinking now about other hearings we've had where there is an initiation, there's an expenditure in the corrections budget for initiating treatment for sex offenders while incarcerated. Are there similar, once a person is incarcerated, either at the gross misdemeanor level or the felony level, are before they're released into supervised community-based service or whatever it is there an initiation within the system of intervention to attempt to change the outcome that this person has with their behavior?
Mr. Adler.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's very common in situations where an individual is placed on probation for the court to put a mechanism in place as part of the terms of that sentence to try to address the underlying issues that are causing the individual to act in a manner contrary to society's best interests. Are there psychological issues that require some type of psychological assessment? Are there domestic abuse issues that require a domestic abuse inventory? Issues that require assessment? Are there chemical dependency issues that require that? And the court has the power to put a mechanism in place or to order that as a term and condition of probation that that offender comply with the recommendations of whatever evaluation they undertook, go through whatever that therapeutic process is, to sign releases so that the probation officer responsible for their case can monitor their process as it relates to this treatment component of their sentence. So I think the courts are very diligent, members of the County Attorney's Association are very diligent in looking at putting a mechanism in place on these probationary dispositions to try to address the underlying problem, because we don't want to see these people in the court system again.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sheeran.
I understand that, and which is the community-based intervention and probation support. But prior to release, while they're incarcerated, are there interventions in the jails, in the prisons, as there are with other kinds of offenders, that they can initiate some intervention on behalf of themselves prior to release from the prison? Do you know that?
Mr. Eblad?
Mr. Chair, Senator, simple answer is yes. The Minnesota Department of Corrections has an extensive program available, and Commissioner Roy is probably the better person to speak about this, but in prison, individuals committed to prison do have the availability to avail themselves to chemical dependency treatment. They do have the ability to avail themselves to sex offender treatment. They do have the ability to avail themselves to counseling. As far as the counties go, the different counties, the 87 counties, it really varies from county to county. One of the things that I've been working on in Santee County, to try to deal with. And I'm hoping that I'm going to have some success with this, but I've been working with our jail staff, our probation staff, our public health staff, and our family services to try to partner with a chemical dependency treatment facility to provide an inpatient treatment program for individuals who are currently incarcerated in the Isanti County Jail. I know there are some counties that do that, some counties don't. It just really depends on part of Minnesota and the county funding and those issues. But there are a number of situations available. The Department of Corrections has extensive programming. I'm cautiously optimistic that in my jurisdiction we can partner with a treatment agency to try to provide some of these chemical dependency treatment related services in our jail for people either serving sentences or the one who avail himself a treatment option prior to the disposition of their case.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Mitchell.
So I'm going to take over from here and give you a little bit of information about our budget. We have a base budget of $1.17 million. About 83% of this budget goes to salaries, and 17% goes to operating expenses. This is what we're requesting for the next biennium. It's the same as what we have in the current biennium. We've had some staffing changes at the commission, and so we anticipate that even if the anticipated contracts that are under discussion are approved, we'll be able to absorb any salary increases with the budget that we have now. So we're not asking for an increase in our base. We are asking for the $1.17 million again. That amount covers six FTEs, and this is the staff that helps support the work of the commission. Consists of myself, one executive director, the management analyst is our trainer, and we also have four researchers. And what we do behind the scenes is really we support the commission in its policy work. We work with the legislature and other task forces and bodies within the criminal justice system to make sure that the sentencing policy that's established here is consistent throughout the state. Our trainer trains over 1,000 people per year, making sure that they understand the guidelines. And she does that in both a web-based format and in traditional classroom settings. We do produce about 10 reports annually that contain that data that show the sentencing trends over the years. And we also answer the phones every day from 8 to 5 for practitioners who are in the midst of actually sentencing and applying the guidelines real time. So this is the work that we do to ensure that sentencing is consistent across the state.
Ms. Mitchell, who does the trainer train?
Who does she train?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our trainer, it's a mix. Probation officers are our primary target because they are the individuals in the system that complete the sentencing worksheets, which is what the court gets to help it understand what the presumptive sentence is. But we also train county attorneys, public defenders, and judges. So we focus on probation officers, but we will provide training to any of the other groups upon request, and then we do a little bit of outreach on our own to make sure that we're hitting those groups as well.
Ms. Mitchell, is there training available for the private defense bar as well?
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely. And
what form?
I actually perform that training myself.
Okay. How do you do that? Through CLEs primarily, or are there some special training sessions that are made available?
Mr. Chair, it's a combination of both. I do the CLEs when the private defense bar is putting that together. So I tend to do those, and then my trainer tends to do the more hands-on, like how do the guidelines work and how do you calculate the score when, you know, you have this scenario, that sort of thing. So actually, sometimes we partner and we do that together, and sometimes she'll go out and do it herself, and sometimes I'll go out and do it myself.
And who has access? You've got an online platform, do you not, for calculating the criminal history score and severity level and so on to figure out where in the box a particular case will fall. Who has access to that platform?
Mr. Chair, our electronic worksheet system, which is the platform you're referring to, is housed on the statewide supervision system. And that system is primarily accessed by probation officers and the jails. So those are the individuals that have access to the information. I think direct access to that system. I think that, if I recall, I believe that other entities within the system have the ability to access the system, but there are fewer of them. So I know that there are some judges who have access to the system and have used it to look up information. I think that public defenders may be able to access it, but I think that the use is a lot less frequent for other practitioners.
If a practitioner, private bar or in a county attorney's office, for example, wanted to verify or double check on the accuracy of the probation report or the pre-sentence investigation presented to the judge, is there an easy mechanism to do that? I mean, it's kind of a black box for a lot of people, I think, and I suspect a lot of practitioners who get that report and they may not have all the raw information available to go back and actually verify that, you know, a particular defendant does fall in this box and not that box on the sentencing guidelines grid. How would a practitioner go about doing that?
Mr. Chair, typically what happens if someone other than a probation officer wants to understand the information that's in the sentencing worksheet, they'll call our office directly. We can pull it up, and then we can talk that individual through what was on the worksheet. Now, it is the probation officer's responsibility to determine what criminal history will go into that, and we don't have access to the systems that they're using to find that criminal history. So the probation officer is the one that's best positioned to have that discussion. But in terms of how all that fits together to create the presumptive sentence, that is part of what we do every day when we talk to practitioners on the phone, walk them through it.
Okay. But say someone from the county attorney's office or the public defender's office or the private bar, if they wanted to go back and verify the criminal history that the probation officer was relying on, they'd have to have access to some of those databases. Is that right?
I'm going to.
Mr. Chair, when we've had those situations crop up with regard to my practice, and we've known each other for years, so you know that as a county attorney, I carry a criminal caseload and I'm in court myself several times a week. But anytime we've had a question with regard to criminal history and sentencing guidelines, the first step, as Ms. Mitchell said, is a conversation with the probation officer. Both the public defender or private defense attorney and I will have copies of the criminal history and sit down with the probation officer and make sure that we're all on the same page as it relates to what the criminal history is. And I found from a practitioner standpoint that most of those guidelines-related questions can be answered by sitting down with the probation officer and the two sides and looking at the criminal history and just double-checking and making sure that if there was a conviction that maybe should have decayed off or shouldn't have decayed off, that it was addressed appropriately. There have been very few times that beyond that we've needed to call down to the office, but there have been a couple of situations where after that we've just called down to the Guidelines Commission office and have spoken with staff just to verify as really kind of a second measure of security or checks and balances to make sure that we're all on the same page as it relates to our interpretation of what the status is of the situation.
I think my memory is from the Claims Commission days is that there was one Court of Appeals case where a sentencing worksheet had been incorrectly calculated and it resulted in the wrong sentence and a person was incarcerated for like 8 months longer than they otherwise would have been before the mistake was overturned by the Court of Appeals. And so I'm just kind of wondering, it's a human system and there are human errors that occur, and so I'm trying to figure out where the players can make sure that as few of those errors occur as possible. And if the information isn't readily accessible to all of the players in the system, including the defense attorneys whose job it is to look out for the interests of the defendant, then the system isn't working quite as easily as it, or as well as it otherwise ought to. Mr. Eblad.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, as it relates to that type of situation, if you're dealing with a miscalculated criminal history score, that's really the situation that I had discussed earlier, that it's really the responsibility of parties, if there are questions, to bring those questions to one another, bring those questions to the probation officer right there in the courtroom, or address it prior to sentencing, or get the sentencing continued so you can sit down and flush that situation out. So I'm not familiar with the exact case you're talking about, but it is a situation that is prevented by communication between the parties. I don't know a case, I can't think of a case that I've ever prosecuted where the defense attorney has not had a copy of the defendant's criminal history. That's automatically provided as part of our discovery and disclosure. So any case that I've ever prosecuted, the defense attorney has had the criminal history of the defendant long before the sentencing date rolls around. And if there are questions, then it's important for that attorney to come and ask me and say, you know, this is how I'm reading it. How do you see this? And if we need to go to the probation officer, we engage that probation officer to make sure that we're reading it correctly as well. Because even though I've been a member of this organization for 10 years and have chaired it since 2007, I still find myself calling down to the office half a dozen times a year to make sure I'm interpreting things correctly from a practitioner standpoint.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, members of the committee at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on your question, Mr. Chair, Mr. Ed Blad, if there are errors, how often or what is the frequency of errors that your agency is experiencing?
Mr. Ed Blad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as far as errors or questions with regard to criminal histories?
Well, I would, is there an error rate?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have statistics on what an error rate is as it relates to the drafting of pre-sentence investigations or criminal histories. From the standpoint of an unscientific survey of a guy who prosecutes cases and finds himself in court on felony sentencing days every week, if there are questions that crop up in half a dozen cases a year, as far as just making sure that there are understandings of criminal histories and on the same page. I can't think of the last time that I had to personally deal with one-on-one cases. Sometimes you get questions as it relates to out-of-state convictions. Sometimes you get questions as it relates to convictions in federal court, how to apply those convictions in federal court to the guidelines, or out-of-state convictions, or things that we don't deal with quite frequently. So I know there are questions that crop up in that area that result in, and I wouldn't consider those errors, but it is an area of uncertainty because it's not something we deal with on the high volume every day, at least in my jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, a follow-up?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Edblad, in your previous answer to the chair, you were referencing that perhaps a defense attorney or someone else, the defendant himself, it's up to them to ask questions in the event that they don't understand something. But doesn't the Sentencing Guidelines Commission hold some responsibility, too, in either making clearer the situation before a question is asked? Why would a question arise anyway if we as a state, through the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, are adequately representing what's going to happen to that defendant, so that negotiations or plea bargains can be arranged? Why would there be a question at all?
Mr. Edblad?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess to answer your question with a question, when we're talking about these questions, I'm not sure what type of questions we're getting to at this point, but from the standpoint of understanding the material, the criminal histories are available. The criminal histories are presumed to be read by both the prosecutor and the defense attorney and presumed to be understood by both the prosecutor and the defense attorney. They're presumed to be understood by the Department of Corrections probation officer who writes the pre-sentence investigation. As it relates to the understanding of the guidelines and the responsibility for understanding the guidelines, I think you raise an interesting point, because one of the tasks that we undertook over the course of the last year was putting together a committee, and I was privileged enough to serve on it, where we sat down, looked at the guidelines from stem to stern to try to figure out, can we make these more user-friendly, more understandable, and more accessible and comprehensible to practitioners and members of the public. So from that standpoint, we did undergo an extensive rewrite about a year ago, somewhat of a plain language rewrite dealing with getting rid of repetitive sections, getting rid of some sections of case law that had not been updated in a number of years, and doing some renumbering and reorganizing sections, putting sections together that made more sense in the newer form than they did in the previous form. So from the standpoint of responsibility, I do think it's the responsibility of practitioners in the courtroom to understand what someone's criminal history is, but I have been involved with the rewriting of this, and we saw that as a responsibility of the Guidelines Commission as a whole to see if we couldn't present this information in a language viewpoint. And I know, at least with regard to your last question, I know Ms. Mitchell had something that she wanted to respond to. At least I thought she did.
Ms. Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did. The other way that the Commission takes responsibility for ensuring that people understand the guidelines and implement them correctly is we look at every single sentencing worksheet that's produced. So the probation officer writes that up, puts it together. It's in our system. It's put in a pending status. It gets sent over to my staff. They took a look at it. We anticipated that at that point, about 15 a day or 25% of all the worksheets have something wrong with them. So then we follow up with the probation officers, and we get that corrected before it goes to court. Once that's done, then we release it, and then the probation officer is able to present that to the court and the parties. We then take the data from our sentencing worksheet system and we compare it to the actual sentences that are issued by the court. And we put that together and we find a few more errors every year. There's a cut, you know, I would say at that point there's probably 1 to 2 per month sentences that are issued that are still wrong. Maybe, you know, you might even technically call them illegal sentences. Maybe they're too high are too low. And that's when I come in and I actually call up the judge and I talk them through that situation. And sometimes they have to resentence the individual, and sometimes it's a departure or the charge was amended in the courtroom at the time of sentencing. And once I know that, everything is correct. That sentence is okay and everything falls back into place. So we take a lot of steps behind the scenes to make sure that the guidelines are being followed, that people understand them, and that sentencing is as good as it can be on the front lines.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mitchell, you had said that 15% of worksheets you found errors on. Would you call that a 15% error rate?
Ms. Mitchell?
Mr. Chair, I would say that it's actually about 25% at that point, but that, yes. And if I can go forward a little bit more in our presentation, one of the things that I am here to do today is to request a one-time funding this year, $300,000, to replace our electronic worksheet system so that we can actually build in some automation and help probation officers with some of those policies that trip them up and make sure that we catch those even sooner in the process.
So, Ms. Mitchell, you're saying that there may be a 25% error rate in the probation department process, but that before it ever gets to the court for consideration, those errors are almost always corrected. So what goes to the judge then is maybe 1 or 2 a month in which there is still an error of some sort. And even among those, there might be some that were not erroneous but just didn't reflect changes in the courtroom at sentencing. Is that right? So if we were to decide, I mean, how many people are actually sentenced at an erroneous sentence because of an error in the worksheet, it's much, much smaller than just a fraction.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly right. You summed it up very well. Thank you.
I heard someone over here also had a question. If I missed it, I'm sorry. Come on back to it. Why don't you go ahead with your budget presentation so that we don't fall too far behind in our schedule here. Go ahead. Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I will go pretty quickly because I've already told you some of what's in here. So I already told you what our base is. We're asking for $300,000 one-time funding for the first year of the biennium to replace our electronic worksheet system. The worksheet system is where the sentencing worksheet resides. And again, this is the tool that probation officers use to figure out what that criminal or what the presumptive sentence is. And it's just one example of why do they need a tool. If you think about the two axes on the grid, the severity level and criminal history, criminal history is actually, there's actually four things that go into that one number on the bottom. It's your felony, your prior felonies, prior targeted misdemeanors and misdemeanors, prior juvenile offenses, and custody status. So you have to put all those together to create the number that comes up with that score on the bottom. So that's why they need a tool to help work through those types of issues to get the presumptive sentence. As I mentioned, once it's completed, we look at it. It goes to the court. This is just explains what I already said to Senator Limmer. So why do we want a new system? You know, number one, we do have that error rate up front that we want to try to correct. But really, there's a technology issue here as well. We are located on the statewide supervision system. There are currently two platforms for that system. There's an old platform and a new platform. We're the last piece left on the old platform. And now that we're sort of trying to communicate with the new platform, that communication doesn't work as well, and there's some, you know, computer glitches that are going on. So it'd be helpful if we could move over. But when we move over, we want to enhance the system so that it works better and we eliminate some of those errors. So what do I mean by the kinds of errors that we can eliminate? Number one, just basic data integrity. Probation officers right now, when they initiate a sentencing worksheet, have to input the case information. We would build an integration over to the court so that we could pull that in electronically. We wouldn't have data entry errors just from retyping. Oftentimes, probation officers are using criminal history from prior worksheets. So we would allow them to copy and paste that criminal history forward from an old worksheet. But it wouldn't be just like a blanket copy and paste. At this point, we have the opportunity to give them a warning to let them know that we think a particular offense may have decayed. Under the guidelines, if an offense is over 15 years old, it doesn't count for criminal history anymore. So here's an opportunity for us to say, bring it forward if it's still good, but don't bring it forward if it's decayed. We also would build in some automatic data checks for any of the sentence components in general. Like I said, we would alert them to any offenses we think may have decayed. If there's a mandatory minimum, that's a legislatively created minimum sentence that applies to the offense. We would give them a warning if they haven't indicated that it should be applied. We would take care of those juvenile history application issues if the offender is 25 or older. We would give them a warning to say, this is not an offense you should be using for criminal history, and we'd alert them to conditional release terms, make sure that those are included in the sentence. These are the kinds of things, smaller errors that occur on a daily basis that we do work with probation officers to correct. So if we could catch those up front when they're filling out the worksheet, we could eliminate a step right there and make the process faster. We also would calculate the presumptive sentence for them automatically. The grid would live behind the scenes in the system so that once we know the severity level and the criminal history score, the presumptive sentence would come up automatically, and that sort of eliminates the error of, you know, looking at the wrong cell on the grid when you're trying to write down what the presumptive sentence should be. And then we would also, at this point, apply the mandatory minimum sentence and any modifiers. If it's an attempt, that impacts the length of the sentence. So this would be a chance for the system to help the probation officer do that. And then just for efficiency purposes, I told you that my staff looks at every single one of these worksheets. Right now, the probation officer fills out the worksheet, submits it to us, and then they have to sign back in to find out if we have reviewed it. So what we'd like to do is build in an automatic email notification that tells them that we're done with it and they can proceed and take that to the court. It'll just speed up the whole process. So the Department of Corrections, they do a survey on a regular basis of all of the probation functions and how much time it takes to complete them. And that survey found that it takes about an hour and a half for a probation officer to complete a sentencing worksheet. So when you multiply that out by the number we get every year, that's almost 25,000 hours spent on the sentencing worksheet. So we shared with the probation officers what our automation would be and asked how much time we thought it would save them. And they thought it would be 15 to 30 minutes per worksheet, which works out to somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 hours that we could save for probation officers so they could spend the time supervising offenders rather than filling out paperwork. So the total cost of the project is about close to $500,000. We already have $2,000 of that. and our remaining need is $300,000. So that's why we're requesting the $300,000 one-time funding for this first biennium. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Are there any further questions of the presenters? I'm only going to add one thought, and then we'll move on to the next group. But what you do is in the broader picture, is you oversee the system of defining proportionality between various offenses and various criminal histories. But you do it only for the felony level offenses, even though you can take into consideration some of the misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor criminal histories. So it's an incomplete, it's an important, but an incomplete picture of the overall proportionality of criminal offenses in the state of Minnesota. And so what this committee will be confronted with on at some point, I anticipate, is some determinations about proportionality between offenses. As we see bills coming through that are creating new offenses or redefining levels of offense, we'll have to make some judgment calls about where it fits in the bigger picture and whether it should be listed as more serious or less serious in comparison to other crimes that already exist in the law. So that's more of a commentary. So with that, I thank you, County Attorney Edblatt. Thanks for driving down from Isanti in a day that the roads probably weren't so great. We appreciate that. And Ms. Mitchell, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kingery was paying close attention, so we'll have him give us some information later. All right, we're now going to invite the Private Detective Board to come forward and present your budget overview. Welcome, Mr. Cook.
Chair,
good afternoon.
I need to speak to you today. My name is Greg Cook, and I'm the newly appointed Executive Director of the Board of Private Detectives. I would like to highlight some of the information provided in the handout. Our current budget is an appropriation of $120,000 annually. The agency receives fees from applicants and license holders, which are deposited in the general fund. The fees range from $800 for an individual protective agent license to $1,900 for a corporate private detective license. The agency's board is made up of 5 members, 2 members from the public, 1 member from the protective agent industry, 1 member from the private detective industry, and the board chair is the assistant superintendent of the BCA. Also present at the board meetings is a representative from the Attorney General's office, as well as myself. The board meets once a month and reviews applications, officer changes, license renewals, training courses, training instructors, complaints, any current topics, presentations from license holders and the general public. On average, the agency processes between 130 and 140 applications, renewals, and officer changes per year. My job as executive director is to process the applications, officer changes, and license renewals, set the agenda for the board meetings, review training courses and instructors for certification, conduct investigations regarding complaints, respond to inquiries from law enforcement, license holders, and the general public, conduct investigations into unlicensed activity, present industry-related topics at board meetings, represent the board at Office of Administrative Hearings, as well as administrative tasks. The application process is extensive and includes verification and investigation of all information provided on the application, 6,000 hours of documented work experience related to the field, proof of financial responsibility, personal and work references, FBI and BCA background checks, and review in person by the board. Once an applicant has been approved for license, the agency monitors further required compliance through the renewal process. Continuing compliance includes obtaining certified education units, meeting the criteria of a criminal history check, continued financial responsibility, and review of any penalties and violations. Currently, the agency regulates 300 license holders. This includes 217 private detectives and 83 protective agents. These entities employ an estimated 6,000 to 7,000 security officers and investigators. The agency also regulates 80 training providers that offer 1,064 certified courses. Some of the areas license holders provide services for are uniformed guard and patrol services, corporate investigations, event security, insurance fraud investigations, executive protection, pre-employment and employment investigations, security assessments, identity theft investigations, criminal defense, and missing children investigations. The agency's current goals and initiatives include streamlining our procedures, increasing agency efficiency, facilitating a statute revision advisory group, revision of current forms into electronic media, website enhancement to better educate the public, elimination of our current backlog, facilitating an unlicensed activity advisory group, organizing and analyzing our data, development of an electronic database, and review of training standards.
Mr. Cook, could you say a little bit more about your backlog, please?
Yeah, there was a vacancy, Mr. Chair, there was a vacancy prior to my being appointed and my coming on board. And there was some applications that had needing attention.
So how long is the backlog, or how long is the delay now?
We have made great strides in eliminating the backlog. We've got it down probably half to what it was. So I foresee in the future us being able to process applications 4 months or less. Once we get through, we've got about eight more to go, and then we'll be able to go 4 months or less on these.
So at its longest backlog, how long was it taking to process an application?
We did have some applications that were going 16 to 18 months on average.
Down to about half of that now, you'd say?
Yes.
And that was because a vacancy went unfilled?
It was partly of the vacancy, and you'd have to ask the prior former executive director why some of these things took that amount of time.
That's troubling that there be applications that have to wait that long for review. What's the process of considering an application?
Well, an application, when somebody applies, we go through it. We make sure that we verify all the information that's in the application, all the identifiers. We have to make sure they have 6,000 hours of work-related experience to their field. At the end, they get interviewed by the board. We have to do a lot of personal and work reference checks on the applicant. There's other investigative techniques we use, such as just looking through the internet to see if the entity has another business somewhere. We check with the Secretary of State, make sure they're registered with the state.
So how many of these applicants are entities and how many are individuals?
I don't have the exact figures. I would say probably 80% are entities and 20% are individuals, roughly.
So you could license a company then,
yes,
for example?
You can license an entity as a corporate license.
Is there any difference in the process that you go through?
There is a difference. When you have a corporate application, there are four individuals in that corporation, the CEO, the CFO, the representative, and Minnesota manager, all four of those, as opposed to an individual, just doing that on the individual.
What's a qualified representative?
Qualified representative is somebody who meets the criteria of the 6,000 hours. He has experience in the field. He represents the company. The Minnesota manager is one who actually facilitates the day-to-day business of the company.
So in the corporate entities, you've got at least one person in there that sort of meets the subject matter expertise and skills and experience.
Actually, two, the qualified rep and the Minnesota manager both have that kind of experience, 6,000 hours.
Yeah, it's troubling that there would be such a long backlog.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you we've made great strides in moving forward from that backlog. We've made a lot of accomplishments in that area. So I see the future, us being able to process these a lot faster.
How long was the vacancy in the agency that contributed to the backlog, do you know?
About 5 weeks. 23rd to July 1st. I was an interim. I came in as an interim on July 1st.
So it sounds like that could not have caused too much of a backlog by itself.
No, it was a small part of it. As it was explained to me, some of the backlog started prior with the government shutdown the prior year in July, and it kind of started as a wave.
Did the agency receive staff cuts as a result of The budget circumstances in the last several bienniums, do you know?
Yes, the agency has.
Do you happen to know what the staffing level was for being able to conduct the background checks, say, 5 years ago compared to today?
I believe 5 years ago there was a full-time administrative assistant. That got cut down to a half-time, a three-quarter time, and then a half-time. The administrative assistant was eliminated in November.
This past November?
Yes.
Okay. And so who actually conducts the background checks then?
Now it's me.
Just you?
Yep.
And before you had an administrative assistant to help with that work?
Yes, Chair.
Yeah, I would assume there's a fair amount of just administrative work in conducting a background check, just gathering of data that doesn't require, you know, certain levels of expertise that you may have.
There is. As I said, I'm fairly new, and I'm trying to find more efficient ways of processing these applications. Example being, it's all done through paperwork. If you can have the system moved onto an electronic system, it would speed things up tremendously. There's parts of the statute affecting the process that are kind of holding things up. For example, the bond. I'm continually looking at these things and analyzing them to try and see how we can do this in a more efficient manner.
Well, if you have suggestions for changes to the statute that might maintain the level of integrity and confidence in the licensing, but might facilitate being more efficient, please let us know. Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cook, on your board, you have a number of people, and I see that you have protective agents and private detectives on the board. Are they former practitioners, or are they currently licensed?
Senator, Mr. Chair, they are currently working as private detectives and protective agents.
All right. And, Mr. Chair, the other question I had is on some of the information I have here is making reference to fiscal years 2011 and 12 regarding applications that are approved. 2011, it says 11. In 2012, it says 24. But it doesn't give me a figure on the total number of applications that have sought approval. Is the 11 in 2011 or the 24 in 2012, is that up? Could you give me a percentage of how many get approved when they seek it?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, pretty much when they come before the board, they'd have already gone through the background process. Mm-hmm. And I cannot give you any exact figures of what get approved. I can tell you from my experience, I have not seen any get not approved as of yet. I do not have, other than those figures you see there, which were taken from the meeting minutes, I do not have current statistics for a lot of other things that I'm trying to put together because I need that data as well. But that's going to take some time finding that data, one thing.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Cook, if you would allow me to rephrase your comment, am I to believe that 100% of applications sought are approved in 2011 and 2012?
Again, I do not have figures of what was not approved in that time frame.
Mr. Chair, I see that there are reissuances that are not approved in 2011 and 2012, 9 in 2011 and 5 in 2012 that were not approved on reissuance. I was just wondering, we didn't have any figures on the original application of whether or not anyone is denied. And is it to assume that there's some requirements that applicants who read it may, there's a requirement that's contrary to their background, they just wouldn't apply, and that's why we don't have a record of denial of applications?
That is possible, yes.
Is there a way that perhaps you could get us some information regarding that, how many applications are sought, and then the corresponding number of those approved?
Mr. Cook, you can turn to your non-existent administrative assistant to help with that.
I'll turn to myself. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I can get that data, because that would be the applications that are being sent out, and that was not being tracked anywhere I've seen. In fact, I am having a hard time kind of finding some of the data that I would like to see as well. I mean, I would like to see 40 different categories of data that helps me analyze a situation, and I am having a difficult time finding that data.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking this question is I'm just wondering if anyone wants to be a private detective or a detective agent. If they apply, they all get a license, or is there some sense of propriety that we exercise that actually denies someone sometime in our history that we've ever said, no, you don't qualify? We think that perhaps your background may be contrary to the protective interests of having a license. And I think it might be important for us to know that just as background information.
Well, Mr. Cook, why don't you consider the request made that if you've got a way to incorporate some data collection and to the extent you have data available, you can share it with the committee, sort of information about applications versus those that are approved. And any denials that were issued. I would assume that if you find deficiencies in an application, you may point those out to the applicant, and they either recognize that they can't make up the gap and they drop their, they withdraw their request, or they, or it just kind of sits until they come back to you with better information.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Some people do drop out in the process. Again, I don't have those current figures. My job as the executive director is to bring the information to the board and the board's decision. They interview the applicant, and I don't have a vote on it. So they take it from after I get done to say, well, they've filled out the application, they've done everything they needed to do for that, and I prepare a synopsis for the board, interviews the applicant, and then votes on whether they get licensed.
My recollection, this is going back about 25 years now, but that there were occasions when applications were denied and the applicants would challenge that denial, and there were some hearings before the board or follow. I'm just thinking, well, because I served in the Public Safety Division at the Attorney General's office, and the lawyer that represented the Private Detective Board at that time had on occasion to deal with some of those questions. Have you come across any of that kind of experience yet where a denied applicant has sought a particular hearing or something like that?
Mr. Chair, no, I have not.
Are there any further questions, Mr. Cook? Go ahead and finish your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Private security investigative industry provides key support to governmental public safety efforts. A report from the Department of Justice notes that the ratio of private security public law enforcement averages 3-1. In certain areas, such as downtown Minneapolis, the ratio is estimated at 13-1. According to the Department of Labor, the private security industry is considered one of the fastest-growing industries in the nation, with an expected growth rate of 17% by 2016.
I guess one other question I have for you is, who's responsible for taking disciplinary action against a license if there's some level of misconduct that is determined or is alleged against a license holder? Is that your agency?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. Those matters are brought before the board and discussed, and a penalty is assessed. Sometimes a license can be revoked. Hasn't happened while I've been there. Suspend licenses, but normally it's a penalty between $100 and $500.
If there's a an investigation to determine if there's been a violation of the terms of the license, is that your job also to conduct that investigation?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
You got a lot of hats you wear there. I think my memory must be of there being some disciplinary action or revocation proceedings that might have occurred when I was in the Attorney General's office that required the additional assistance of the lawyer. You still utilize the Public Safety Division's attorney with the Attorney General's office for assisting the board? Do they appear at the meetings and advise the board?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have an attorney general representative that attends every board meeting, and there is also someone I can ask questions with as I'm conducting my job.
Any further questions of Mr. Cook? And what exactly was your budget request then for this?
The budget is $120,000.
And that was the current biennium's budget as well?
That's correct.
You're asking for the same amount of money going forward into the next biennium?
That's correct.
What was the basis for eliminating the administrative assistant?
Shortly after I came in as an interim position, we were faced with a deficit. And in talking to our finance department, we could find no other way to eliminate the deficit other than eliminate that position.
And do you feel that you alone have sufficient resources to conduct your job without an administrative assistant, even a part-time one?
Mr. Chair, I'm still analyzing that, but I am doing my due diligence. I do believe that, again, looking at the procedures and how we're doing things, it's my job to work within that and make sure that I can still give the proper oversight to the applications and issues.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Okay, we'll welcome the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner Lindsay, Deputy Commissioner Santiago, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that all the members of the committee had a copy of the PowerPoint.
If this is it, it's in our packet, Commissioner. Thank you.
I thought what I would do is first give a brief overview of the Human Rights Act, the operations of the department, and to inform you that our biennium report will be provided to the committee later this month. The department has not issued a biennium report to the legislature in over a decade, so we thought it was important to provide such a biennium report to give an update as it relates to the operations of the department. The act itself, it provides that it is a public policy of the state to ensure that Minnesota is free from discrimination in the following areas: housing, real property, accommodations, public services, and education. So the breadth of the Human Rights Act is very broad. There is no one federal agency that has the same breadth of responsibility for investigating claims of discrimination as the Department of Human Rights. Look at the respective subject matter areas. If we were talking about the federal level, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency charged with investigating claims of discrimination. But it does not have any responsibilities in the area of housing, public accommodations, or public services. You would have to take a look to the Department of Justice, Housing and Urban Development, all of those respective federal agencies, merge them all in one together, one large agency. And that would be what is analogous to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights on the state level. The Minnesota Human Rights Act also, in certain instances, prohibits discrimination against a broader number of protected classes of individuals than law. And that's significant because there might be certain instances in which citizens of Minnesota have greater protections under state law than they do under federal law. The Human Rights Act, it identifies 19 specific duties for the commissioner to engage in and to provide for citizens in the state of Minnesota, but there are three duties which are specifically called out for emphasis for the commissioner. The first one is to issue complaints and investigate charges of discrimination. The second is to ensure that all state vendors provide equal employment opportunities. And the third is to use education, conference, conciliation, and persuasion to eliminate discrimination and disparate outcomes. Also, guided by the governor initiative of better government, specifically people who live and do business in Minnesota, rightly expect government to work fast, better, more efficiently. You serve in government have an important obligation to improve how it works. We have taken that to heart. So during this biennium, the department has streamlined its processes to increase efficiency. And the history for the department, for myself, before I became commissioner, I practiced in the area of employment law. And in the early 90s, the department took a significant long time in which to process charges of discrimination. And the commissioner was provided with the opportunity and the ability to dismiss certain cases even after ascertaining that jurisdiction would exist for the commissioner to investigate charges of discrimination. 2 points from that. One, to reduce the timeline for conducting those investigations, but not to continue the practice of dismissing cases without doing a thorough investigation. These next 2 points, there are sometimes competing interests, efficiency versus timeliness. So we've focused on completing more investigation memorandum. We've also focused on reducing the time to complete investigation. The department issued 238 investigations in 2011. Last year, the department will issue 597 investigation memorandums in 2012. We've more than doubled the number of investigation memorandums completed. During the last 6 months, the average age of probable cause of termination has dropped to 357 days, and the average age of no probable cause of termination has dropped down to 293 days.
Commissioner, what were they before?
The legislative report that was submitted by the department to the legislature last January of 2011, both were over 400 days. 423 days for no probable cause and 400 probable cause determination. I should say that there are still some cases we have in our inventory that are beyond this average. And that we're still working hard to address and complete those investigations.
To what do you attribute the drop, besides brilliant management?
We go to the next slide. I wouldn't say brilliant management, but brilliant ideas from the staff. So one of the first things that I did is I asked all of the staff what were their best ideas for reducing the timeline. Some of those ideas resulting in us streamlining the charge drafting process. Staff indicated that they would like training in several areas. And again, if we go back to the Human Rights Act itself, we're not just simply talking employment. There are other areas of discrimination that investigators need to be aware of. So we were very intentional last year in providing 10 training sessions to our enforcement officers. We also implemented what we refer to as a rocket docket. It had been culture and practice within the agency that when a new investigation would come in, a charge, I should say, came in, that it would go to the back of the line as relates to charges being investigated by enforcement officers. I had shared with them that in private practice, if there was an easy case that came in, that attorney sometimes would address that respective easy case when it came in. And I should be very clear on this, that when we say rocket docket, it's not just simply to quickly and summarily dismiss cases. So, for instance, we had one which was a rocket docket in which a restaurant owner was unaware of the fact that they needed to allow a guide dog in if an individual was visually impaired. They seemed to think they had to exclude the dog from the respective premises. Again, that's probably not a case which needs to go to the end of the line. Probably a quick call or conversation with the restaurant owner can resolve that respective dispute. We've also reorganized our respective operations.
Also,
part of it is that we had two groups within the enforcement area. We had four or five enforcement officers who were only responsible for the respective charge and what we refer to as an investigation information assessment, or an IRR. We would have that unit only focus on that area, not on actually conducting investigations. I had shared with the department that to me it made sense to combine that unit with the individuals who were actually doing the investigation, and then assign one or two individuals within the group for being responsible for taking and drafting of charges. So we combined that those two groups. So we now have 12 enforcement officers who are responsible for conducting investigations. When individuals come in with a respective charge, the expectation is that you're going to meet with the individual and that you're actually going to complete the charge within 7 days of initial contact. We had done an internal study, and it unfortunately had been taking the department around 60 to 65 days from the initial contact, the actual drafting and delivery of the charge upon the respondent. That was savings of more than 50 days, and just that streamlining of operations. I'd like to move to the second specific primary duty identified under the Act, and that the issuance of certificates of compliance and ensuring equal employment opportunities are provided under state contracts. For these contracts, we're really talking about and focused on contracts which reasonably are likely to exceed $100,000. We ensure by two ways. The first is the issuance of certificate of compliance. So if you wish to work on a state project, prior to submission and award of the bid, you have to submit your affirmative action plan to the department. The department is then responsible for reviewing that plan, informing you as to why it is not in compliance within 15 days. Currently, law then allows another 15 days for you to address whatever deficiencies or problems that you have. The second way in which employment opportunity policies are provided is by examining the actual practices of the vendors after the award has been given to the individual. Then we either do a desk audit or on-site audit as it relates to the practices of that.
Commissioner, what do you think that $100,000 threshold is an appropriate threshold?
We've had some conversations as it relates to the amount of the threshold. There is also one other component within the administrative rule, and that is to the vendor employing 40 full-time equivalents for at least one day within the state of Minnesota. The way in which work is now being reorganized and done by companies, it may be worthwhile to take an examination of full-time equivalent component as opposed to the respective dollar amount. We're in the process of sort of working with and then in it now to be able to track the respective contracts which are coming in to the respective state. We would probably be in a better position after we be able to say, should that be something under consideration to change, modify.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, on the point on the compliance for those contracts over $100,000, could you give me an idea, is like most of the contracts over $100,000, or maybe that's just the big projects we hear about, but what's the ratio of those above 100 and below 100 so I can get a scale of what your job is?
Sure. Senator Lemmer, sure. And Mr. Chair, my understanding is that contracts which we are performing an assessment at either a desk or an on-site audit, all of those contracts have exceeded $100,000.
All of them?
Yes. All of them. The language within the statute and the administrative rule suggests contracts, for example, you were at MnDOT or Department of Admin, you should inform the department if there is a possibility that your contract could exceed $100,000, and then that would trigger ensuring that your vendor submitted an affirmative action plan and for us to audit. But in looking at our inventory of actual contracts that we are auditing now, all of the contracts exceed $100,000.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Commissioner, are these... I know that your agency is requesting two or three more enforcement officers for the compliance of state vendors, and are they would they be considered full-time employees, or are they on a contract basis?
Senator Limmer and Mr. Chair, they would be full-time employees, not on a contract basis. There are several large contracts about to get started here within the state of Minnesota. And just before coming here, I had sent off a letter to the Minnesota Sports Facility, one of those respective large contracts here in the next couple of years.
Mr. Chair, the legislature has approved some pretty big contracts. You know, just the Viking Stadium is one, and the St. Croix Lift Bridge might be another. I can't think of any other, but I'm sure there's others with bonding bill proposals on freeways. But the Viking Stadium will eventually get built in a couple years, and so will the Lift Bridge. Is there have you anticipated the demand? Does the demand go down after these big projects, or is it we're just holding your full-time equivalents in reserve for the next big project out there? How do we as the legislature govern the quantity in relationship to the big projects that we have that spike up and then spike down?
Commissioner.
Senator Limmer and Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. In looking at the legislative auditor report from 1986, the department at that point in time had six individuals who were responsible for doing contract compliance for the entire state of Minnesota. Currently, we have four individuals. So from a historical basis, I would say that we are down at least two full-time equivalents, and I think an argument could be made that we would probably needing an additional full-time equivalent given the population size increase since the last legislative auditor report. And I do appreciate you acknowledging sort of the size of the St. Croix Lift Bridge project, and we have been in conversation with MnDOT as it relates to its plans over the balance of the decade, as well as the Metropolitan Council.
Mr. Senator Lima. The Lift Bridge raises the question of, I'm sure that's a federal highway project, and it's working in relationship with MnDOT. Are there any federal projects that you had stated in your opening comments that we have a wider jurisdiction on discrimination than the federal government? And if there's a federal project in the state of Minnesota, I don't know what that would be, a dam or something, where it's exclusively federal, do we still, as a state, through your office, still have jurisdiction over how that's done?
Commissioner.
Senator Limmer and Mr. Chair, we can go to the St. Croix Lift Bridge project as an example. So on that respective project, there is actually construction in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. MnDOT and the respective MnDOT within Wisconsin has formed administrative agencies to coordinate with the respective MnDOT. So from the state of Minnesota, MnDOT has convened a working group of seven agencies examining, for example, Department of Labor issues, pollution control issues, and for our vantage point, workforce issues. So we would be monitoring that project for workforce participation. And within your question, it seemed to suggest, would there be a federal agency oversight for such a project on workforce? And the answer to that question would be no. That would be the same, as I understand it, as relates to the Wisconsin side of that respective project.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
During the biennium process, the department was able to process more than 90% of the certificates of compliance within 15 days, and we seek to try to improve upon that performance. We also met with agencies, labor unions, contractors, and other interested stakeholders, and specifically this is to try to ensure that we have a world-class transportation infrastructure. This is not just simply an idea of providing particular job for one group or for one particular agenda. We really are sort of going through a transformational sort of time period from a demographic standpoint, in that we are going to see a shrinkage occurring within the working class adults within the next 15 to 20 years as we have a doubling of the number of individuals over the age of 65. So it's important for us to ensure that we have a highly educated, skilled, trained workforce. Workforce goals for the seven-county metropolitan area were adjusted in April of this past year, and that was to more accurately reflect the changing demographic diversity which is going on. They were changed from 11% to 30%. Goals are generally set for the beginning of the decade and then they stay in place for the balance of the decade. You can change to the last of the primary duties, and that is broadly defined as sort of education outreach. We've also been very active in those respective areas. We attended and presented at the what we understand to be the first Native American Education Summit with a sitting Commissioner of Education. I had the pleasure to address that gathering as it relates to educational issues. Had a chance to speak and attend at various STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math events throughout the year. We've also partnered with community groups to further the effort of Commissioner Rothman to ensure that financial literacy exists among all Minnesota citizens. We also had the opportunity and pleasure on serving on the Governor's School Bullying Task Force, which has produced a report, and I understand that there's legislation from that report that's before this body. We've also had a chance to convene and participate in meetings with community members around collateral consequences and employment. That refers to the arrest and conviction records that may follow an individual and the negative impact on that individual to become gainfully employed. We've also participated in listening sessions with Congressman Ellison on this respective issue. Highlighted it earlier that the request itself is for two full-time equivalent for the contract compliance unit. I do think that I remind staff that I really do appreciate their efforts because if you take a look at that legislative auditor report, more than 20 years ago, there was actually more full-time equivalents within the department. And fair to say and difficult to argue to the contrary, that we are much more efficient as relates to the processing of compliance matters and questions that the committee had.
Senator Hall.
Chair and Commissioner.
My question is a simple one. Do you think that we have more human rights violations today than we had 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Is society getting better or are we getting worse with the violations?
Commissioner?
Senator Hall and Mr. Chair. It's a short question. I don't know if it's an easy question. I think there, in some ways, we as a society are becoming much more tolerant of others. But I think that we still have respective issues that we need to deal with. And it's important to have the Human Rights Act, Human Rights Department, and for we as citizens to come together and talk about some of the differences that exist among us to get to what I would refer to as sort of that next evolution beyond just simply tolerance, sort of respect and admiration for one another.
Okay, and Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do we have any kind of a gauge to tell us where we're at in our society? Is there anything out there that gives us a... I know it's a tough one to figure. That's why I thought, is there somebody that's come up with something to gauge not only our country, but our state?
Commissioner?
Senator Hall and Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the question. It does remind me of sort of the proverbial clock as relates to sort of are we getting closer to nuclear war or nuclear holocaust, and sort of are we 10 minutes to midnight or 15 minutes to midnight? I know of no such... I know of no such thing out there which indicates how well we are progressing. There are some which would say in the area of criminal justice, like Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow, which would suggest that we have gone backwards as relates to criminal justice issues. There are others which would say that the disproportionate minority contact on the level report, which was just recently issued, which would suggest that we are willing to engage in more of an active dialogue, and the numbers there would say that we're making progress, would suggest to the other. I truly appreciate the question. It's rich food for thought.
Mr. Chair, I would just add myself. It seems to me over the last few years, human rights violations have gotten worse. And that's just my own personal perspective, and I'm kind of surprised by that because I keep thinking we evolve or we do a better job of what it is. And I'm not here blaming anybody because I really don't know, but I just find within my own knowledge, soul, understanding, that's the way I've seen it, and it troubles me.
Senator Hall, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question and comment. I would say when we had our Human Rights Day symposium December 6th of last year, one of the cases which was discussed was the Two Harbors case, which got to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And almost to a person within the audience, when it was discussed about the abuse and sexual harassment which was occurring in that case, was very surprised that such a case was still occurring within the state of Minnesota. So, yes, there are examples which suggest that we may not have come as far as we'd like to believe that we have on these issues.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
And to that point, that would probably be the area of sexual acting out that I think our society seems to only be getting worse and worse. And not to blame, but the media certainly has a big part to do with that from my point of view.
Senator Hall, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. If we were just simply to look at the employment cases which were in the offices of the Department of Human Rights now, we would see four large groups which they would come from. One would be disability, one would be age, one would be race, and the other would be gender. And in the gender component, the primary, and they would be evenly split. Depending on sort of what day that you ask the question, we might have more disability as opposed to age as opposed to gender. We do have a significant number of gender cases. And of those gender cases, by far and away, they're not A. They are more of the harassment sexual nature.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lindsey, the governor's budget suggested changing a $75 compliance fee to $150, but it would be collected once every 4 years rather than once every 2 years. Numerically, it doesn't seem like there's any difference, but could you tell me why that's requested in that timetable?
Sure, Senator Limmer and Mr. Chair. This is actually the second time in which the department is making this particular proposal. We made it last year because one of the things the governor asked all of the respective agencies is could we streamline burdens upon businesses, and we thought that it would make sense to streamline the request, the number of times that they have to respond. So that's why we had pushed it back out to 4 years as opposed to every 2 years.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, do you anticipate any more or any less investigations based on that timetable of payment?
Senator Limmer and Mr. Commissioner. Chair, just so that we're clear, the payment that you referred to in your last question, that referred to a certificate of compliance. So that would be an individual contractor, not as relates to a number of investigation charges coming into the department. I don't anticipate, well, let me say this. I anticipate that we will probably see an uptick in the number of certificates of compliance being requested in the next 16 months because of the Viking Stadium and St. Croix Lift Bridge project. Do I see a trend line where we will see a much larger number of certificates of compliance for the balance of the decade? No, I don't see that. I see that we'll see an uptick in, again, that short window of time, and then it will probably level out over the balance of the decade. As it relates to number of charges, we have seen more charges in the last 12 months than prior 12 months.
Mr. Chair, I probably used the wrong word in my question. I used the word investigation. I think I was really trying to get the review of the certificates, and that's not going to change by changing it from once every 2 years fee to a once every 4 year fee.
Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right.
Any other questions for the commissioner? All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay, we are going to gavel out of the finance division. Everyone stay put, though, or you'll be considered absent when we regavel into the policy. Give us just a moment so we can change the tape. We're adjourned on the finance division.